James Gregory from Plymouth, worked tremendous variety of very exciting subjects. Famous book on vegetarianism in Victorian Britain. Also worked on, published three books that are in print and more in the pipeline, but also a book on the reform of capital punishments in 19th century Britain. But two new projects, one on Chartist poetry and also eccentricity in 19th century Britain. But today James will be talking on 19th century reformers, and the title is, as we've got here, What's My Motivation, Personal Integrity and Other Springs of Action in the Lives of 19th Century Reformers. Okay.
I came up with the title before actually writing the paper, which is always a risk. It sounded fancy to my mind. I think I probably will change it now. But okay, so one might think that integrity was a key word in the discourse of reform, moral, political, social, of the 19th century in Britain, an era rich in movements. Independence, honour, uprightness and motivation are all aspects of discussions about British reformers in this period. How one presented a cause certainly had the potential to invoke integrity. In this paper, I want, or intended, to chart the use of this idea, keyword, through the century, using newspapers, periodicals, pamphlets, and other literary coverage. And so this paper drew on these texts, specifically material from reform activists and leaders, including treatment of motivation within the literature of reform. Digitisation of this material allows us to cover a vast amount of material through keyword searching, and the methodology I've adopted here is to see what a set of keywords generates. And so this research at the moment is primarily on the texts. I have encountered many visual or three-dimensional representations of integrity. Although the public statues of imperial rulers, British statesmen, national philanthropists, local do-gooders might be seen to embody this quality and deliberately memorialise it in epitaphs. Gravestone inscriptions and memorials certainly memorialise integrity of life. As this indicates, integrity was a quality of character to commemorate, as well as to extol or query in the living. Search the New Oxford Dictionary of Biography and one finds it invoked in entries on integritas. This is a very rarely used adjective, but I found it in Google, so I'm going to try and revive it. The integritist philanthropists and reformers such as Thomas Barnardo, whose own career involved lingering doubts about personal integrity, as Gillian Wagner's entry notes. The ideas on integrity conveyed through such a collection as the ODMB encompass hereditary integrity and integrity linked to religious upbringing. I'm not going to engage in a study of the philosophical underpinnings to the idea of integrity. As I say, I'm no expert on this. I found some interesting online essays exploring that, which are lurking in the footnotes to this essay, which I can share with people. But what I'm interested in is definitions and usage of the term at the time. Nor am I able to study the longer history of integrity discourse relevant to my period, which would include early modern texts republished through the 18th and 19th centuries, such as Archbishop John Tillotson of Canterbury, his sermons which refer to truth and integrity. Of course, a broader context of integrity would take in attitudes to political disinterestedness and to expediency or corruption, the hypocrisy of statesmen, and the commercial fraud of the age. For if we think of 19th century keywords, these would surely include sham and cant. Integrity was the opposite of fraud, and it was an age which identified unparalleled commercial fraud. Clive Emsley in Crime and Society in England quotes from a leader in the Illustrated London News in 1843, "If we progress at the same rate for half a generation longer, commercial dishonesty will become the rule and integrity the exception. On every side of us we see perpetually fraud, fraud, fraud." I think at this point I'd better hand round the document handouts, because I'm going to refer to document one in a moment. Joe, can we have the rest? To define integrity, then, one might turn to dictionaries for contemporary usage, or to that useful work, Document 1, George Crabbe's English Synonyms Explained in Alphabetical Order, published in 1818, which examined the word alongside honesty, uprightness, and probity. Essayist 2, the Scotsman Alexander Watson, for instance, in Essays on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral, published in 1821, who nicely defined it as conscientious disinterestedness. Watson indicated, too, its quality in relation to motivation, noting that there were those, quote, who may observe the maxims of rectitude from interested motives without feeling or exercising its faculty as a virtue. One could, after all, do the right things for the wrong reasons. It has possibly been said, observed John Foster, that a man may maintain nice principles of integrity in the prosecution of public affairs, though his conscience and practice are very defective in matters of private morality. Foster's reference to public affairs reflects the fact that integrity as a public virtue relates to opinion, to winning or keeping the good moral opinion of others. A literary scholar has noted integrity as a charged word in this period, the 19th century. The notion of integrity was not, of course, simply personal. Relating to entireness, wholeness, soundness, it can relate to the integrity of the Sabbath in the Sabbatarian age, or of a nation, the integrity of the British Empire, the integrity of Turkey, for instance. And integrity can mean authenticity in relation to texts, the integrity of Scripture, for instance. It rarely appeared alone. If one was to construct a word cloud, and I think my next image is my attempt at a Wordle, we'd get all these sorts of words: spotless, high, unflinching, strict, strictest, unshaken, uncompromising, commercial, political, moral. Research on the personnel and literature of various reform movements of the 19th century, vegetarian temperance, anti-capital, and my teaching about anti-slavery impresses me with the obvious fact, for apologists, the need to have a truthful cause, and the importance of the perceived integrity of participants. These were men and women of principle, demonstrable by their advocacy of unpopular or unfashionable causes. If some reform causes and their leaders might be presented as pursuing material gain in dishonest ways, one thinks of the figure of the hypocritical demagogue duping his or her followers. Activists were often presented as oddities, supporting eccentricities, fads, crotchets, misguided but genuinely held beliefs. That is, there's an appreciation that people could be animated by pure but misguided motives. In speaking of motivation in this period, I need to set out the ideas of 19th century thinkers on motivation, and I have to say it's only something I'm beginning to do in this paper. I subtitled this essay Springs of Action by reference to an essay or a tabulation by Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher, for whom the principal motives were, of course, pursuit of pleasure and avoidance of pain. And so I think the next is my attempt to reproduce the title page of this work published in 1817, where he talks about neutral, eulogistic and dislogistic ways of describing motives, desires and interests. For Bentham, presenting his psychological dynamics or science of the springs of action, no act was, properly speaking, disinterested. Bentham accepted that there was the absence of self-regarding interest, but fear of God or hope of good repute were self-regarding. Integrity appears under number 8, pleasures and pains of the moral or popular sanction, viz. Pleasures of reputation or good repute, pains of bad reputation or ill repute, interest of the trumpet. He also refers to it in pleasures and pains of the religious sanction and pleasures and pains of sympathy. And that's Bentham. You can find discussions of integrity in the works of other moral philosophers such as Paley as well. So how did others conceive of motivation in matters philanthropic and progressive? And I think the key imperative for my period is religious and anti-religious, irreligious, the secularist and free thought movement. One of the key texts when looking at integrity in this period is Proverbs 11:3. The integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of transgressors shall destroy them. Integrity, then, could be conceived as a result of pure religion. It was faith that allowed one to resist the temptations and corruption and so become a man of integrity, tested like Job. But integrity was not enough. J.T., writing in the Evangelical Reformer and Young Man's Guide in 1840, argued that men of knowledge and integrity may indeed be useful to us as instructors to show the sense of God's word, but it is the word and revelation of God alone upon which my faith is to be founded. Self-examination, one aspect to evangelicalism in this period, would require the Christian to examine motivation. The man who has been taught to read his own heart feels a holy jealousy of his motives, I quote from a biography of an early 19th century minister. Perhaps few of us, however, we persuaded ourselves at the time of the perfect integrity and singleness of our motives, can review the start of our ministerial career without some such mixture of holy shame. In spiritual biography and the biography of religious figures, then, we might expect to discuss the integrity of the subject. Integrity certainly figures as a theme of Christian sermons, such as the Scottish minister and professor of rhetoric Hugh Blair's Sermons on Integrity as the Guide of Life, published variously in the 1820s and 30s. And I think that's document two, his character of the man of integrity. The popular Anglican clergyman Robertson of Brighton in 1852, his sermon on on integrity, and various earlier sermons listed in James Darling's Cyclopaedia Bibliographica in 1859, sermons listed from the previous century and earlier on the wisdom, the great importance, the inestimable value of integrity, the happy end of integrity, the integrity of character recommended. As something derived from Old Testament teaching, it's not surprising that there's an Anglo-Jewish moral guide, which I found Moritz Davidson Moral and Religious Guide of 1855, which has a section on integrity too. I've also noted a sectarian inflection, the Protestant Advocate of 1814 discussing Protestant versus Catholic notions of integrity, saying there's a very Catholic version, a Jesuity notion of integrity. Also, I found reference to the God of the Scotch as a god of integrity, so a sort of religious nationalism going on in discussion of integrity. There were particular denominations associated with integrity, above all the Religious Society of Friends. In a work published in 1890, Quaker Strongholds, Caroline Stephen argues that the glory of early Quakerism was in its integrity, in its uncompromising, unflinching requirement that the life should bear witness to the truth. Quakerism was supposed to prize strict integrity in business, but this came out of wider concern with consistency. The supreme value, Stephen says, assigned by Friends to consistency of conduct, to strict veracity and integrity, and other plain moral duties, has, I believe, an intimate connection with their abandonment of all reliance upon outward observances. At the same time, the periodical The Athenaeum asks, in what does the peculiar fascination of Quaker biographies consist? The question sets one thinking. The male members of the society had about them a quiet depth of character, an uprightness, integrity, and fixity of purpose. The reputation for integrity amongst Quakers drew on 19th century examples, such as, in the words of the Friends Intelligencer of 1894, the hallowed name of Elizabeth Fry, who would ever occupy in English records of social meliorism a niche. Not ostentatious self-seeking, but silent and unobtrusive manifestations of a life directed by simplicity and integrity. Such a reputation was to be preserved, as noted in the proceedings of the Swarthmore Conference. We must bear in mind that the Friends must still continue to be a synonym for integrity and uprightness in character. I don't have time to, and I haven't had time to look at scepticism and religion and how the figures who present themselves as leaders of infidelity have to present themselves as notably characters of integrity because of their position in a religious society. What I have uncovered already is texts of practical moral instruction, of religious and moral anecdotes, exemplary or instructional moral biographies, which have entries, biblical, scriptural and classical, exemplifying integrity. The archetypal promoter of Victorian values, Samuel Smiles, in Self-Help discusses integrity. And you can find references to integrity throughout the 19th century in magazines, periodicals, of general literature. The Mirror of Literature in January 1823, for instance, details honesty in the humble life. And there's other anecdotes relating remarkable, singular instances of integrity. Integrity is the foundation of all that is high in character among mankind, the Saturday Magazine opines in June 1837. The Leisure Hour, a family journal of instruction and recreation, has various pieces on the reward of integrity or integrity at trial. Poetry too presents exemplars of integrity. The Man of Integrity, a translated Latin ode in the Poetical Magazine in 1809. George Calvert's collection Thoughts for Thoughtful Minds, not surprisingly, has a poem on integrity in 1865. And as one might expect, we have lessons in integrity in children's literature too. So periodicals and tracts and little books for moral instruction. The Children's Treasury in 1877 cites that scriptural injunction about the integrity of the upright and the perverseness of transgressors. Young Folks in 1881 talks about he who makes an idol of his interest will make a martyr of his integrity. And as we'll see in the next slide, hopefully, a whole host of literature produced for children from the late 18th century onwards, which have titles, name-checking integrity. Joseph the Errand Boy, or Integrity Rewarded, and here the tale of Martin and James, or James and Martin. Integrity was to be taught. Thus, Elizabeth Appleton's Early Education, or The Management of Children, published in 1821 and dedicated to the Duchess of Kent, who had taken on the responsibility for her royal offspring, the future Queen Victoria. Appleton stressed, "You begin then the education of your infant, giving him truth, the first branch of which appears to be integrity. integrity begins in thought and is the very soul, essence, principle and foundation of its corresponding honesty, honest words and action. And Appleton says we must, and this is a lesson for all people who have the duty of looking after youngsters, young children, you must surround infants with integrity, crucial source of upbringing, and that will provide a corresponding impression to their mind. The well-known story of Martin and James, written by Lucy Peacock, which displayed the advantages of integrity, was, to quote Appleton, a work highly moral and pleasing. When it was originally published, the Darton edition, which is that edition there, had images to make the story of the admirable little James and the treacherous Martin more amusing to the children. These texts needed to be discussed, lessons extracted, and the importance of integrity taught. And this was a point which Sarah Stickney Ellis believed had been neglected. In 1844, writing a whole chapter on integrity in the Daughters of England, she said, "It's a matter of surprise to some and ought to be the subject of universal regret that in our public seminaries for the training of youth, integrity should occupy so small a share of attention. Even in our works on education, it holds no very important place. And yet I'm inclined to think that a want of strict integrity is the greatest of all wants to a social, moral and accountable being." Whether this is true or not is a subject for further research. Certainly one can find passages selected to illustrate integrity in textbooks for schools in the late 19th century. There are even novels whose titles display the quality as a key theme, and the very first slide I showed you was the fancy design around the word integrity, which was the title of Barbara Hofland's tale, published in 1823. The daughter of a Sheffield manufacturer, Hofland's heroine preserves her integrity through various domestic sufferings and temptations and is eventually rewarded. One finds other serialised tales with the word integrity in their title, Ladies' Monthly Museum, or Polite Repository of Amusement and Instruction has a man of integrity serialised. The Frenchman Louis-Benoît Picard's L'Honnête Homme was published as The Novice or The Man of Integrity in three volumes in 1825. A tale in Chambers' Edinburgh Journal by Anna Sargent looks at the moral of the life of a wastrel son transported for forgery who returns an aged and dying man to his family, published in 1846. I hope I've got enough time to say something about class and gender dimensions. Integrity was observed as a feature of the English gentleman. The English gentleman was a noble man of character, according to the French writer Hippolyte Taine in 1843. A distinctive feature of the English upper class, a real gentleman, was his integrity. Working class political reformers, not surprisingly, when the character of the plebeian radical demanding parliamentary franchise was debated, asserted their integrity too. The voter was defined as an independent man in early 19th century Britain. Assertions of working class integrity appear in Chartist newspapers in the 1840s. The Chartist Circular says, "A man with his fustian jacket is often his equal in points of intelligence and indescribably his superior, very often so far as integrity of purpose is concerned. The day is forever past when rank and wealth can make a man be looked up to as an oracle among the operatives of this country." The working class man's integrity could be displayed by their self-reform, whether temperance or teetotalism, principled behaviour setting them apart from others and held to despite the temptations of the world. For integrity was above all that of the will, hence criticism of a pledge that was required of teetotalers as a demonstration of a lack of willpower, perhaps. Willpower allowed the working man to advance. It was part of self-advancement. To outline the gendered aspects to integrity then, the printed discourse did allow for feminine integrity. There were women of integrity, we'd be pleased to hear. Thus, Sarah Ellis, as we've seen, discussing integrity in a chapter. Although noting that, there is in fact no means of giving a positive definition of integrity so as to make it fully understood. We may call it a straightforward and upright mode of conduct, but it will still remain as before to be considered by young ladies, a sort of thing which belongs to servants and tradespeople, but not to them. Improving Tracts figured women or girls who had displayed integrity. Castle's Family magazine had a paragraph on female integrity. They stand not only of a perfect equality with man. There are references to the integrity of men and the chastity of women. The Liberal politician Robert Lowe, in a discussion on the second reading of the Regimental Exchanges Bill in 1875, refers to the honour of a woman, the integrity of statesmen, and the honour of a soldier as things that ought not to be sold. Integrity appears in 8 specific examples in Elizabeth Starling's Noble Deeds of Woman, an American text, but circulating in Britain from the 1830s onwards. Women had already written on political integrity, Hannah Moore arguing in her Hints for Forming the Character for a Young Princess, which was written for Charlotte, Princess of Wales, had a whole chapter on the subject as well, arguing that integrity was the true political wisdom. Politically, integrity is a central concern. James Gilray, which is, I think, the next part.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, we'll have the image, I think.
Okay,
yeah. James Gilray entitled one of his cartoons in 1811, Integrity Retiring from Office. It relates to the resignation of William Pitt the Younger and his ministry, and we have the opposition Whigs, Jacobinical figures, sort of rushing to fill the vacated offices but being held back by a soldier at the Treasury gate. Statesmen were disinterested. Public integrity was to be stressed in the school for statesmen, as in infant education. Honesty really was the best policy, according to an old MP writing for would-be statesmen after the Reform Act in the 1840s. Public as well as private virtue is ever strong in conscious rectitude. He's arguing that statesmen need to display integrity. And these manuals, I suppose, are reflecting back on classical guides to oratory, referring to Quintilian and others, and talking about the need, in order to be a perfect orator, to evince a character for rectitude and integrity. And voters needed to be assured that they could place confidence in politicians' integrity, that their men were independent and undeviating in their principles. Politicians publicly asserted the integrity of their motives. They were animated by patriotism and principle on the hustings, and when they came to give an account of their year in Parliament, they would assert their integrity as well. So John Bright in 1857 tells his electorate that he has acted with integrity, as reported in the papers in 1857. Radical reformers present their calls for parliamentary reform to as a conflict with partial measures and expediency. We have John Cartwright's splendidly entitled pamphlet of 1810, The Comparison, in which mock reform, half reform, and constitutional reform are considered, or who are the enlightened and practical statesmen of talent and integrity to preserve our laws and liberties. And you find in Chartist journalism as well, people concerned about asserting independence and integrity against perhaps leaders who they believe are being too demagogic. It requires a little effort to find complaints about lack of political integrity now, as in the 19th century. Politicians might distinguish between their opponents' integrity as private men and their character as public men. They might complain, and there are many complaints, that integrity is a handicap to political success. Certainly, in this period, we have a conscience which ensures, a nonconformist conscience that ensures that moral integrity has a political, a national resonance. Thus, for instance, in the case of Charles Stuart Parnell in November 1890, ensuring his political disgrace where he seemed to act in a way which shows his lack of integrity. The minister, Hugh Price Hughes, commenting in 1890 when Parnell is implicated in as an adulterer, he argues famously, "What is morally wrong can never be politically right," a phrase which has already been made commonplace since Charles James Fox uttered it earlier in the century. How am I doing for time?
Oh, you're fine.
Okay. Integrity was to be sought in a commercial, financial, and business context. A reputation for integrity was obviously something to advertise. Companies might employ the word in their title. You find Integrity Life Assurance and Sick Benefit Society in the 1860s. There's an Almondbury Integrity Provident Cooperative Society in 1865. There's an Integrity Lodge, a Masonic Lodge earlier as well. Improving Literature caters to would-be men of business, giving them lessons on punctuality and integrity, and the way to succeed as businessmen. The rewards of integrity and hard work were documented. And this is hardly surprising, since many reformers and philanthropists had gained experience and wealth as commercial men. This had been their occupation. Business trust and untrustworthiness in the 19th century has been the subject of a lot of rich research by historians, scholars in English literature, looking at white-collar fraud, commercial criminality. And as George Robb notes, the primary check on promotional fraud was the integrity of the individual promoter. literary scholars have studied the subject in novels, plots including commercial speculation and the trials and tribulations of men of integrity who have to somehow accumulate the money to pay back their creditors who've lost money through no fault of theirs. With Thomas Haskell, we might argue for the relationship between capitalist trust and humanitarianism, that one's word in business circles was of direct relevance for inspiring faith in one as philanthropist. People spoke of integrity in public life. Integrity was a public virtue, along with industry and sound judgment. Advertisements for all sorts of posts called for integrity and honesty. Integrity in teachers, would you believe it? Integrity for assistants, accountants, business partnerships, and domestic servants. Do I have 5 minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've got 5 minutes to actually answer what I purported I was going to do in the actual paper, which is the integrity of the reformer. So that was the discourse of integrity and the context in religion, politics, and sort of fleshing out gender and class. To give some of the 19th century figures in philanthropy and reform who present some of this discourse applied, let's begin with Lord Shaftesbury, perhaps the obvious figure to begin with. No group grassroots activist, to be sure, but an evangelical animated by noblesse oblige and presented in the press as an exemplar of integrity, in whom, to quote one source, all the elements of a grand philanthropic life were harmoniously blended. In 1842, in the context of his work to do with reforming conditions in coal mines, the London Standard spoke of him as having that calm reliance on the integrity of his cause and the justice of heaven common to all noble natures. And Posthumous Eulogy makes much of his character as a man of integrity, his unflinching integrity, his refusal of offer from Sir Robert Peel, but his sense of right and integrity, which means that throughout his life he's a trusted advisor of public men. From the aristocrat to middle-class men of trade, the Quaker John Bright, I think John Bright is my next image, and Richard Cobden. Bright wrote a public letter on integrity in business. He was asked by a secretary of a YMCA to reflect on it, and his letter was published in 1884. And he certainly has a reputation, his public persona, as a man of incorruptible integrity. And this is presented in works for children. There's a popular sketch of Cobden and Bright, which emphasises that they're both plain men of integrity entering politics. There's a eulogy to his father, in actual fact, in Francis Cook's An English Hero, the story of Richard Cobden, which again implies this hereditary feature of integrity. Old Bright, this old Quaker gentleman, was always to be entrusted, and that honour and integrity were to be found in him at all times. And these people have international reputations. We're looking at people who are certainly famous in America as well, so that American newspapers, when Cobden and Bright die, they emphasise very much that these are men of trade who have shown integrity in their business lives and have become integritous in their public life as well. Samuel Smiles, referring to Cobden in brief biographies, talks about him as a man of rare intelligence, of unswerving industry and of spotless integrity. And throughout the texts relating to him in, after his death in 1865, one finds references to his iron integrity, his lack of self-aggrandizement, his refusal to accept office from Palmerston for those reasons as well. The instinct was surely sound, John Morley says in his Life of Richard Cobden, which told him in 1859 that something would be lost to the integrity of his political character and conscience. Humbler reformers and philanthropists, people humbler than Shaftesbury, Cobden and Bright, were eulogised in terms of their integrity, of course. Humble temperance activists might only have their zeal and integrity to qualify them to speak in public. Dickie Turner, one of the pioneers of teetotalism in Preston, was cited in 1846 after his death as a sterling example of teetotal integrity. Indeed, temperance writers spoke of supporting the reclaimed man and preserving his temperance integrity from the dangers of the unreformed alcohol-ingesting wider world. I could multiply the instances of integrity in British reformers' discourse and in biographical material infinitely. Reform of lifestyle involved testimony about the reasons why an individual adopted temperance, in which motivation related to consistency might be aired. So vegetarians debated endlessly whether they should extend the membership to people who didn't avoid eating fish, flesh and fowl, and it was debated in terms of sustaining the purity, the integrity of their regulations. Moral reform required one to adopt other related causes, lest one's integrity be impugned and accusations of hypocrisy made. some causes were actually about integrity. Vegetarianism presented itself as about bodily integrity, and if one thinks about the Anti-Contagious Diseases Act, it was all about preserving the integrity of the female body from the interference of the state, the police, in relation to prostitution. I had hoped to locate integrity within the lives, letters and memoirs of a whole host of integritist activists. The wonderfully named Zachariah Mudge, in his account of the Christian Statesman, Sir Thomas Fowell Buxton, I found references to the link between his family, gamekeeper, and his childhood inculcation in the principles of honour and integrity. I looked through obvious biographies like Josephine Butler, couldn't find any reference to integrity there, despite her exemplification, as we find in the Hatton Gallery, her portrait as one of the females of the Northeast. You can see her now. She refers to her father as a man of integrity, but doesn't dare apply it to herself. It's not there in reference to William Thomas Stead, the man associated with the campaign against infant prostitution. There's no mention there. But I'm sure, given time, you can find it in biographies and autobiographies of many of these people. To wrap up then, integrity could not merely be asserted. It was something tested, and for which evidence of resisting temptations to deviate could be found. Like probity, it was subject to public scrutiny. If a reformer could not convince others of his or her sincerity and integrity, the implications were that there was an ulterior motive, material, sordid. People could have their motives judged in law too. Character testimony in court and through libel. And I think one of the interesting aspects is to look where people go awry when there's embezzlement in funds associated with charity and moral reform causes, where the cause seems to be damaged by the association. We speak about transparency today rather than integrity. But integrity was understood to be about holding fast to one's principles in practice. As Reynolds' Miscellany of Romance aphorised, concealment is the tomb of integrity. In the polemical exchange in reform between opponents and within campaigns, integrity had to be maintained and asserted. But concealment was ultimately impossible. William Wilberforce, facing an onslaught on his character in 1830, which he described as a very artful manufacturer, as a pamphlet attacking him, wrote, "God, thou knowest my integrity." Integrity was a virtue that would be transparent, as all things were, to the Almighty. Yet one might find comfort, given that the perfect integrity was impossible, in the belief that God forgives the motive and employs the man. But what happened to integrity when human motivation became a warring of conscious and unconscious desires, and God's existence as ever-present I doubted?